On Tech News Today, Microsoft buys Minecraft. Plus, Apple's new Apple Pay and HealthKit puts the company into uncharted territory as a bank and healthcare device maker, and it could be regulated accordingly. And Google officially rolls out its Android One platform. All that and much more coming up right now.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Monday, September 15th, 2014. This episode is brought to you by Gazelle, the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. Find out what your used iPhone, iPad, and other products are worth at gazelle.com. And by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. For a free two-week trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use the offer code TNT. Tech News Today is the show where we talk about the tech news with the journalists who report it. Welcome to the show. I'm Mike Elgin, and I'm not Jason Hell. Jason Hell is the guy over there.
That's me. Yeah. I'm the guy over here.
How you doing, Push Jason? Buttons.
I'm doing good.
How was your weekend?
Good weekend. Yeah. Productive. You know, I was alone with the kids, so it was a little harrowing at times, but it was all good.
Nice.
All
good. Fun. Always fun. you've got pretty young kids, so that's really fun.
It can be a challenge, but hey, swimming pools solve all.
Oh, I know, so. Right. Just throw them in the pool.
Yep.
Yeah, that's pretty much my my mother's philosophy. She was actually a lifeguard when I was a kid, and I've spent, you know, my whole day, like, in the pool. That was really awesome. And we also have Lindsay Turrentine because it's Monday. Welcome, Lindsay Turrentine.
Good morning.
And how was your weekend?
It was really nice. It was warm and full of soccer games, so there you go.
Oh, nice. Everybody was being very physical except me. Spent the weekend doing something. I
lazy.
Don't know what I was doing. Yeah, lazy, sitting around, living off the side.
You know, hosting Twit.
Hosting Twit, whatever. Yep. That's a desk job. Uh-huh. So anyway. No big deal. Let's jump into this. Speaking of sentient activity, we have a news about a video game. As rumored, Microsoft today agreed to buy Mojang, the company that makes Minecraft. The price is $2.5 billion. The company founders won't be staying with Microsoft, though. They're going to go off and build something else. Max Jeter Palmgren wrote about the Mojang acquisition for Forbes and joins us now. Welcome to you, Max.
Hi, how's it going?
It's going great. How did I do with your name?
Oh, excellent. I'm actually surprised by it.
I'm surprised you're telling me that. So what's Microsoft going to do with Minecraft?
Well, I guess we'll have to see. I mean, one thing for sure, they are getting a super dedicated audience with Minecraft and already a big money-making machine in Mojang. So, we'll see.
I noticed you pronounced it Mojang and I pronounced it Mojang. I was trying to be Swedish. Which do you prefer?
Probably more right. Well, Mojang comes from Mojang, which means little thing, actually. So if you want to be real cool, you'll say it Mojang.
Well, that's what I want to be. So I'll go ahead and do that. Now, why are the founders leaving? It seems like a cushy job at Microsoft might be a sweet deal, but they're all leaving.
Nah, they're leaving exactly the same reason why they sold. I think the only reason they sold is it's not about the money. They're just tired of it. They were not in it for the money. They were not in it for the fame. These are hardcore game developers, and they want to spend time creating small-time games, and that's what they want to do. And that's not what they're going to be able to do at Microsoft.
My kids are you know, like all children their age, they spend most of their free time playing Minecraft, and they are huge. They're hugely dedicated to it. Do you think that this is going to help PR for Microsoft over the very long term, that there's going to be a much warmer feeling about Microsoft because it's associated with Minecraft?
Well, I think it is. I mean, Minecraft has some very hardcore fans, and some of them might be very disappointed today and they might be leaving. But the vast majority, as you say, who plays this are kids, and they just love the game. And the kids and their parents have no idea who leaves today or whose hands this in. So, of course, this is a great thing for Microsoft, I think. So, yeah.
You know, my kids, actually, they know who Notch is, and they talk
they do,
about
yeah.
him. They talk about him all the time, which is really interesting. He's like a character in Minecraft to them. So they might be a little bit disappointed, but I'm sure they would never stop playing.
Well, Notch is actually all of a sudden the hottest game developer in the world in terms of what his next move is, because, of course, he's going to go off and do something else, which probably means building another game of some kind, I would guess. I mean, he seems really passionate about it. And as we learned, he said he's, quote, tired of answering to Minecraft fans, according to the Wall Street Journal. It sounds like he's just burned out from the fame. And it sounds like he wanted originally to build a small little community of passionate people, not a gigantic community of passionate people. Big communities of passionate people are a real pain in the neck. And so, we're curious to see what he's going to do next. What do you think he's going to do next? Is he going to create another open world game, or do you think, he's going to do something entirely different?
Well, and that's exactly what I think he will try to do. I mean, he hasn't really been involved in Minecraft development for a couple of years already. He's been trying to create this, building on this game, which I've already forgotten the name of. It's, but I'm sure you'll find it out there, which is like Minecraft, a big community built in the open space, so all about collaboration. The thing about Notch, which makes him this like super interesting guy to follow, is he's very open where he is, where he stands, and following his Twitter account is one of the most interesting guys on Twitter, and he's been very open with the troubles he's having being creative and what Mojang and Minecraft is, how that's affecting him and how development is going with this next game. So if you're very curious about what's happening next, I mean, just follow him on Twitter. That's like my best suggestion for all of you guys.
Yeah, and he's a real character, and he's now an extremely wealthy character. Mm-hmm. He's getting a big chunk of change from Microsoft, and that is a good thing. Now he has the freedom to do pretty much whatever he wants to do, and he sounds like the kind of guy who likes to do whatever he wants to do. So we'll see what he does next, and we'll, of course, follow up on any news from Notch that comes down the lane. Max Jader Palmgren is at Forbes.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at MaxJeder. Thank you so much for joining us, Max.
Thank you for having me.
All right. In just a sec, we've got a couple of news stories coming out of Apple, little follow-ups from last week. But first, I want to tell you about Gazelle. Gazelle wants to buy your used iPhone. We've all got them lying around. At some point, any of us who've ever bought an iPhone and never got around to selling the old one or giving it away or whatever, we've got these things lying around, and they're worth a lot of money. And you can find out exactly how much money they're worth by going to gazelle.com. That's GAZELLE.com. Find the iPhone that you possess in your drawer, in your garage, whatever, and indicate its condition, and they'll give you a number. That number is the number of dollars that Gazelle will give you for that device. You know, dealing with an old device is usually, or at least it used to be, a big, big hassle. You got to find a recycling center, whatever it is you're going to do with it, or sell it yourself. That's the old way to do it. Gazelle makes it super, super easy. That's, in my opinion, because I'm lazy, the very best thing about Gazelle. It's so easy to do. You just go through the process, see the price, click on the Get Paid button, and they'll send you a box. You put your phone in the box, and off it goes. They pay for all the shipping. They do all the labeling. You pretty much don't have to do anything other than put a phone in a box, close the box, and put it in the mailbox. That's all you have to do. And what Gazelle will do is they'll pay you fast by check, PayPal, or with the Amazon gift card option, they'll give you an extra 5%, which is really, really great. They'll even wipe the data on your device free. So if you've got any data or you're not really sure if you've got personal information on your phone, don't worry about it, because Gazelle will completely erase it so that nobody will ever be able to retrieve your personal information. Find out what your iPhone is worth. Take a minute and go to gazelle.com to find out. Well, Lindsay, it's a really interesting sub-story from all the Apple announcements last week that Apple is now in a couple of new businesses. The first business that it's now in is the healthcare equipment business, and that's really an odd place for Apple to be.
Yeah, this is pretty interesting. Apple is just getting its feet wet with some clinical trials, and they're very small clinical trials, but Reuters had an exclusive on two U.S. hospitals, one at Stanford and one at Duke, launching trials to demonstrate how Apple HealthKit will work or could work between patients and doctors. The trials target diabetics. The first one is at Stanford and targets children who have type 1 diabetes and do a lot of monitoring of their blood sugar. And the second is at Duke, and it targets people who are monitoring their blood pressure and their weight. So this is, you know, these are small studies. I think the Stanford study has two patients working with them and their children. They're going home with iPod touches to monitor, to take information from their blood sugar testing and then feed it to their doctors. And Apple wants to see whether this smooths things out between doctors and patients.
Well, you know, it's funny that they're using children. My guess is that children who don't go to bars and therefore don't leave their Apple devices in bars, and therefore they're perfect people to send home with an Apple device that nobody's ever seen. It's really a fascinating thing. And of course, you know, if Apple goes down this road where, you know, you can see the trend lines here, if this turns out to be a reliable piece of kit for medical measurements, For these particular uses, you can see them using it for additional uses, which means that Apple would then be eventually regulated as a medical device supplier. And all kinds of really great things will happen. One of the most fascinating to me is that right now, a lot of diabetics and people who are on any kind of medical program often have to record by hand the details of their treatment, of their symptoms, whatever it is. And if you can really embrace a consumer device like the Apple Watch, then a lot of that becomes kind of automated, and you can remove a lot of error and uncertainty from the process. I mean, doctors have to rely on what patients tell them, and patients may not always be the most reliable indicators of what medications they're taking, what activities they're doing, what their measurements are in terms of biometric measurements. So this could actually, you know, it sounds like kind of a flaky deal to use a consumer electronics device for medical uses, but in fact, it's probably the opposite.
Well, I think what Apple is capitalizing on here is the fact that a lot of people already own these devices and are, you know, they're willing to use them, and they do as a part of their everyday life. So if you can get if you can integrate that device into part of the regular communication between the doctor and the patient, then that smooths things out a little bit. Although I will say, I myself am type 1 diabetic. A lot of these technologies exist already. So some of this coverage makes it sound like this is the first time, you know, doctors and patients have ever used technology to step in where previously people were having to write down things like blood sugars. The reality is I haven't written down my blood sugars for years. I have a blood monitor that I can just hand to my doctor and they download all the information, or I can download it onto my laptop and email it to them. So I think what getting Apple into the picture will do is make it even more seamless. The reality is I usually don't email it to my doctor. What I do is just hand them to the device when I go to the doctor's office. What they're hoping to do is get that communication to be even faster, so that, for instance, the blood monitor or even an embedded, one of the device manufacturers they're talking to makes a monitor that goes under the skin and feeds information to, say, I don't know, maybe it could feed information to an iPhone, that software and the health kit software is actually feeding that in a live feed to the doctor so that the doctor can be alerted if something's going awry before something dangerous happens, which is especially important for kids who may be separated from their parents and maybe not able to catch it themselves.
Yeah, of course, one of the concerns for regulators and hospitals and others, of course, is the fact that Apple's in the position to actually get all kinds of data, not just the health data. And the question is, are they going to grab location data? Are they going to grab other data? Are they going to grab, you know, this is a ridiculous example, but are they going to look at, you know, your purchases through Apple Pay and see that you're buying donuts if you're a diabetic, something like that? I mean, there's all kinds of things they could do theoretically, or that third-party apps could do. And so, of course, the regulators are going to want to make sure that this is clamped down. I believe Jason is telling me that we do have an interview related to the story. The story was actually written by Christina Farr at Reuters.com. And Christina joins us now to talk about this. Thank you so much, Christina.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, I know that you are very busy today, and it was a great story. We really wanted to get you on for this story. Now, so can you just give us a quick summary of exactly what Apple is doing with these hospitals in terms of the trials?
Absolutely. So Apple first announced HealthKit at WWDC in June. And since then has been making steady progress with just locking down partnerships in the health world. Last week at its big product launch event, Apple briefly discussed two partners, Duke University and Stanford Children's Hospital. So I called up my contacts there to find out a little bit more about those first two medical trials and discovered that they both involve taking care of patients with chronic conditions like diabetes and allowing these patients to be able to go home and use Apple-enabled devices like an iPod Touch. And Apple can then give that data or share that data with the electronic health record, and the doctor can view it and make more proactive decisions about a patient's health and send alerts. So it's a very interesting idea, and we'll see in the coming months how these trials go.
Christina, if these trials go well, do you think that the process will be relatively quick getting something like this through the FDA, where I assume the FDA would have to approve of any system that works with medical devices like blood monitors? Do you think Apple is ready and equipped to deal with that process and maybe even speed it up a little bit?
Well, certainly Apple's in touch with FDA, and we know from just looking at public calendars that they've taken meetings with key officials. But the way that HealthKit works, it doesn't appear that it will be regulated by FDA. The devices, the medical devices that would track a patient's blood sugar or potentially blood pressure and other metrics, they are FDA approved and will build integrations with Apple's HealthKit. HealthKit is merely a repository of that data where it can be viewed in connection with other types of data that might be relevant for a physician to get a more holistic picture of a patient's health beyond just one data stream. So that's the goal for HealthKit. It sort of sits in between various types of data and can be pulled together in one place. And from there, doctors can view it to make clinical decisions.
Now, do you, Christina, imagine a world in which research centers, hospitals, and so on are creating their own apps to work on Apple Watch, number one? And number two, can you imagine a world in which Apple behaves like any other company within the medical industrial complex, as the New England Journal of Medicine calls it, and going and actually marketing the Apple Watch to doctors and sort of imploring them and bribing them, you know, with their own Apple Watches to recommend these devices to patients as a sales mechanism, as the pharmaceutical companies do?
Great question. I had another piece a week ago where we sort of explored the health use cases for the Apple Watch, and I spoke to doctors just to gauge their opinion on whether or not they would buy up this device. I think for now it's a little bit early to say, as we're still learning more and more about the sort of potential implications for the watch on the medical side. I think, though, it could be used by doctors in the future, especially versions 2 and 3 and 4, which no doubt will have many more medical use cases and be able to track metrics beyond just heart rate and a patient's steps. So we'll see. I do think that Apple sees this watch as potentially being, you know, both a consumer device as well as, you know, in the future, potentially even an FDA-approved mobile medical device. But that remains to be seen. Apple sort of moving. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I was just going to say, I find the monitoring part of this to be very interesting. I actually think that it's going to be a very long time until these devices can do any sort of the futuristic stuff that we talk about, like blood sugar monitoring, because that's actually, it's a very difficult problem to solve. Currently, any sort of skin-based sensors have to go under the skin, and they can't actually monitor blood. They have to monitor the fluid between your cells. It's very complicated. I think it will be many, many years before something like a watch can do that. But what I'm wondering is if a watch could be a great alert system for a doctor, right? A way to sort of get an intercept and say there's something wrong with someone else, or could that be sort of overwhelming to them?
Well, when Apple announced the watch, they also announced WatchKit, which is the API. So developers can use that to build their own applications that sit on top of the watch. So I've already been talking to developers who, you know, for instance, a company that specializes in medication adherence, and they send alerts to patients when they need to take their drugs. you know, whether it's, you know, just like a reminder of sorts that it's that time of day. So, you know, you could imagine a consumer wearing the Apple Watch getting an alert saying, hey, you know, reminder, take your medication. That I think that's very plausible in the first version of the watch. As for, you know, the watch having sensors that could potentially do this tracking on their own, like you say, that is a number of years off. One of the key areas that a lot of kind of medical firms are exploring now is the potential for non-invasive and continuous glucose monitoring. But that is still the holy grail, and we are a number of years away. So for now, I think it's going to be the WatchKit API that other developers will use to be able to build more sophisticated monitoring tools.
Well, I just hope that the combined price of an iPhone 6 Plus and the Apple Watch together don't give people heart attacks. It's going to add up to quite a big amount. And I hope everybody who needs to use this sort of thing can afford the Apple Watch itself. Christina Farr writes at Reuters.com, and you can follow her on Twitter at Chrissy Farr with two R's at the end. I want to thank you for taking the time today, Christina. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. Well, Apple last week, of course, announced Apple Pay, a mobile payment system that will enable iPhone and Apple Watch users to buy stuff using their Apple hardware. But a new report published by The Hill says Apple might soon find itself being regulated like a financial institution. Julian Haddam is a reporter for The Hill and joins us now. Welcome, Julian.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Glad you're here again. Now, why do you believe Apple might be regulated in this way?
Well, partly that's what some of these regulators have said. After the Apple Pay announcement last week, there's a realization that now this is a company that is not just letting you access the internet and read your email and call people. It's also letting you spend money. And there are agencies like the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which was a new bureau set up after the Dodd-Frank Act, after the financial crisis. And it said essentially that all of its existing rules on credit cards, Visa, MasterCard, on any other money transmitters also apply now to mobile technology, mobile payment companies in general. So not just Apple Pay, but also Google Wallet and the Starbucks gift card, pretty much anything where you can use your phone to make a payment. And that includes like a lot of things potentially. As you mentioned, you know, privacy is a big deal. If you're spending $500 at Dunkin' Donuts or whatever, MasterCard, there are legal limits about what MasterCard can do with that information. And there's also now legal limits about what Apple can do with that information. And so for a company that has not had to deal with some of these regulators, it is they're going to get some new looks. And I'm sure their lobbyists and their lawyers are meeting with people to talk about what's going on here.
So in these cases, even though Apple is not actually a bank and won't be storing any money, what will these regulators be looking for? What do you think that they'll be trying to prevent from happening? What kinds of things could go wrong with Apple handling financial information?
So one of the big things that the CFPB, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, has been big on is transparency and disclosure and making sure that people know essentially what they're getting themselves into. This was an agency that's done a lot of work with mortgages and student loans and stuff like that. So I'm sure there'll be a lot of focus on making sure that Apple's disclaimers are easy to read and not 500 pages of jargon that don't make any sense, and that it's basically clear to people when they will have to pay fines or fees, if they might have to pay fines or fees, and when they won't. Also, of course, you know, privacy is a really big thing. As you mentioned, you know, credit cards currently do not know where you are. They don't have access to your geolocation as well as, you know, your email and all these other features. And it can be easy to see how that might raise new questions for these agencies, whether, you know, if you realize that you're right outside of a donut shop and you have spent a lot of money on donuts, it might be problematic if Apple gave you an alert, if your phone gave you an alert saying, hey, hint, hint, here's a donut shop. That could potentially violate some privacy restrictions. But really, I think what this highlights is that this is really, really a new area. And for the most part, regulators don't totally understand this zone, and they're just kind of slowly working their way into it. We saw a similar announcement earlier in this year with the Federal Trade Commission that Apple is required to give $32 million or so in refunds to people whose kids spent money on their Apple iTunes store with buying apps without their parents' permission. And so things like that, and now it gets a lot bigger now when not only can you spend money at the Apple store, but you can also spend money at Starbucks and Target and all these restaurants and everything else.
Well, thanks a lot, Julian. And now I'm craving donuts. Thanks for that. We learned recently that Apple will be taking 15 cents for every $100 spent through Apple Pay. And that's an interesting factoid. It's significantly less than I thought it would be. But how big of a change is Apple Pay for the payments industry? I mean, this industry has been slugging along for a while now. What do the banks and credit unions think about all this?
I mean, this is a really huge deal. There have been similar technologies before, but you know, when Apple does it, as we saw with the iPod, with the iPhone, it's a whole different ballgame. And you know, I talked to people who said, you know, we've been using credit cards for 40 years. We've been using credit cards. We've been using cash. Sometimes we've been using checks, but that's pretty much it. Now there's this whole new technology that's really burst onto the scene, and you know, potentially could change the way everybody buys anything. That's what Tim Cook has said, that no one will ever buy anything the same way. This will be the replacement for your wallet. That's, you know, could be a really big deal. Companies are still trying to get a handle on what this means. And this is, it's kind of a wonky issue, but this has been an issue of a lot of lobbying battles here in Washington. Banks and credit card companies went through a huge fight a couple years ago over the tiny fees that happen when every time you spend your credit card. And you know, it seems like a small thing, but there's millions and billions of dollars at stake in these fights and these battles. And it's unclear exactly how Apple is working with these companies. They obviously have buy-in from a lot of the big banks as well as retailers. So we can assume that they're supportive in some respect. But yeah, this is really just kind of, you know, really coming in and changing up the market in a way that we're only at the beginning stages now, and I think it's going to be a process that goes on for a number of years.
Yeah, specifically Visa, MasterCard, and American Express are on board, as is Whole Foods, Macy's, and Disney. Those are the six companies that you mentioned in your article. It was a great piece. I really enjoyed reading it. It was good stuff. Julian Hatem is at thehill.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at JM Hatem. That's H-A-T-T-E-M. Thank you so much for joining us, Julian Hatem.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Well, Lindsay, we heard about the Android One launch at Google I.O., and then they launched it for real this morning in India. Tell us about it.
Very early morning hours, U.S. time, this rolled out in India. And this is the first step in the Android One project, which Google's using this project to try to get Google devices into the hands of the next 5 billion customers. Right now in India, only 10% of users, and it's a very large population, has a smartphone. So this is a huge opportunity for Google. And to do this, they're working on stock Android rolling into some $100 devices. They're working with Indian carriers and 3 major Indian manufacturers, and they rolled out 3 new phones this morning.
And these are super, super cheap. And as you said, they're designed not to replace other cheap smartphones as much as they are designed to replace feature phones that, you know, sort of upgrade people. It's also an attempt, I believe, to ultimately get people who are currently on sort of non-Google versions of Android, the kind that don't have access to a Play Store, that don't have access to Google services, and get them on board with the whole Google program so that to a certain extent Google can monetize those users, and also gain some control over that ecosystem, because a lot of the implementations of Android in the third world, in the emerging markets, kind of give Android a bad name because they're so poorly implemented and the performance is so bad. I saw a lot of those in Africa when I was traveling there, that just, you know, people just didn't have a good experience with Android because they were on some unauthorized, no name, no brand sort of Chinese knockoff device, and it wasn't a good experience. Do you think this is going to help them succeed against the feature phones? I mean, it's a step up from the feature phone crowd, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it all depends on price ultimately. If there are other cheaper phones that still come in at $50, then it won't work. But I think it stands a very good chance of working. And I think that Google has been very smart and learned from what it watched happen in China. Forked Android invaded the Chinese market. And so now there are a lot of big and small manufacturers doing it the right way and doing it the wrong way, but not necessarily doing it the Google way. And Google wants to make sure that anybody who owns one of their devices is using all of Google's ecosystem, like you said. So it wants to, if it gets in early, I think Google knows that it will be able to get people hooked on those services without wanting that extra layer of software or service provided by another carrier or manufacturer. There's also, it's difficult though, I will say, because I know that in certain markets like Indonesia, which is one of the markets slated to get these phones by the end of the year, the end of 2015, I believe, the rate of change in just the language itself in Indonesia is incredibly fast. So we have to think that Google has a lot of people on the ground in those local regions working on things like making sure that the language used in the operating system is accessible to everyone, because there's just so much diversity in that market.
Has Google said how long they're providing updates for Android One? Is it like a standard two-year thing? And if so, I mean, could it be assumed that people in these markets are going to hold on to their phones for a lot longer? And then, you know, 2 years down the line, Google has this kind of PR issue where all of these phones aren't getting updates and suddenly their numbers of, you know, current running. Because I think that's another part of this, right, is that for the longest time, Google has had because it's an open platform and anybody can do anything and, you know, create their own overlays, Google doesn't have control in the same way that Apple does. So then when it comes to updates to new versions, Google's really just kind of left waiting for a year for the current version to get 25% install on devices. And that's a big criticism. Now they suddenly take control and they say, well, actually, this huge market of devices, you know, this next wave of devices are all under our control, so we're able to goose those numbers. But 2 years down the line, are those people like still holding on, expecting to hold on those phones for 4 or 5 years, and suddenly that bites Google in the butt later? I don't know.
I think it's a really good question, but I assume, and this is just an assumption, that because these must be stock Android, Google, it's a little bit easier for Google to update the phones for a long time.
Yeah, that's what I'm hoping. Yeah.
Yeah.
The other problem they're going to have to deal with is just the fact that, you know, okay, so they give everybody access to YouTube. Now the users have to pay for the bandwidth that they're using. And oftentimes in these same markets that they're going after, you know, they're paying, sort of little by little. They pay for every little bit that they use. And, of course, Facebook has something called the Free Zone and also the Internet.org to sort of subsidize the use of wireless connectivity. And Google itself has something called Free Zone, which is in the Philippines, Indonesia, and South Africa and elsewhere. And they're going to need to expand this if they really want to get Android out there. The whole point of Android One and Android is Google services, and Google services gobble up data, so on one's data plans. And so they're going to have to deal with the data plan part of it in addition to just having free phones, otherwise, or cheap phones. Otherwise, this isn't really going to fly.
Yeah, they have a few things to address that, it sounds like. 200 megs of apps downloaded from Google Play won't count against the data plan. The YouTube app there has been tweaked so that it has an offline mode, which actually everybody would love to have an offline mode for YouTube.
Yeah, I know.
For videos that you watch, you know, repeatedly or whatever, it'll store it on, so you only really have to download it once. Their market gets that, and I don't know if other markets are getting that right now.
I think, you know, Facebook is actually doing a lot to pioneer that with the pre-cached video. And I kind of assume that Google's learning from what Facebook is doing and taking advantage of that, this idea that we've already cached some videos, so, you know, you can, there are some problems with that. But if Wi-Fi infrastructure gets strong enough, which it's not across all of those regions, that could be helpful too.
Yeah, absolutely. And they'll also have to do something that, like what Facebook is doing with, like, changing the ads depending on the connection, so serving up text ads for some people and video ads for other people. I think all the companies are going to have to do something like that. Anybody who provides ads, serves up ads in different emerging markets. Otherwise, they're just going to gobble up resources on ads, and that'll be the end of it. Well, in just a second, we got a bunch of follow-ups from last week's Apple and other coverage. But first, I want to tell you about Squarespace. Squarespace is an awesome place for you to build your own website, and you should build your own website because it is fun and it's beautiful. And most of all, it is super, super easy. You'll be shocked at how easy it is to create a Squarespace a website. Just go and choose a template. You start with one of their beautiful templates, beautifully designed. I mean, these are really nice. You can use a logo creator tool to create your own logo. If you don't want a logo, you can do your, you know, own images, put in your own typefaces if you want, or accept the typefaces that came with the design. You can change the size, add pages, get rid of pages, really super flexible. Add a blog to an existing website. The website might have 10 or 20 different pages with different features, but one of those can be a full featured blog, and then you can import your existing blog in there very easily so that all the posts you've ever posted on your old blog can be reflected with the new design on your new Squarespace blog. You can sell digital and physical goods using a single interface because of Squarespace's ability for you to sell things and raise money for your nonprofit or sell things or whatever. You can track customer activity using a marketing pixel or include an affiliate program tracking script. There's all these professional tools for selling things just like the big sites. You can even accept donations, great for nonprofits, cash wedding registries. My own son is getting married in about a month, and he's using Squarespace for their registry. Really awesome stuff. School fund drives, whatever. Whatever you need to do to raise money, Squarespace is the place to do it. And it starts at just $8 a month, and that includes a free domain name if you sign up for a year. Squarespace, of course, also takes care of the hosting, and they are top-notch at hosting. There is no better hosting out there. So don't wait. Start your free 2-week trial with no credit card required and start building your website today. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure you use the offer code TNT to get 10% off. And we thank Squarespace for their support of Tech News Today. We reported on the new Motorola products a couple weeks ago, and now we've learned that the new Moto X phone and the new Moto Hint earpiece, the little sort of like thing from the movie Her, both came available for pre-order tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. Pacific, so you can order those on pre-order and then do it in time to watch Tech News Today at 10 a.m. Pacific tomorrow. And the ongoing saga of Amazon's war with Hachette, the Hachette publishing company, gets a new chapter. If you recall, Amazon was accused of turning the screws on Hachette by dropping some of the publisher's books from the Amazon.com site in order to force the company to accept Amazon's negotiation terms. Now Hachette writers and their supporters have written a letter directly to the Amazon board, and they are turning some screws of their own. In that letter, they wrote, quote, "Efforts to impede or block the sale of books have a long and ugly history. Do you personally want to be associated with this?" Unquote. Well, we have a few follow-ups from our Apple coverage from last week, starting with the Apple Watch. Tim Cook revealed a small detail about the Apple Watch, namely that it'll be able to play music and podcasts without a Bluetooth-connected phone. That means fitness fans can leave the phone behind while they go off running somewhere. And it's nice to hear that the 2015 Apple Watch will be at least as capable as the 2010 iPod Nano. Well, despite the pre-order glitches we reported, Apple claims to have sold more than 4 million iPhone 6 and iPhone 6 Plus handsets in the first 24 hours of sales. That's double the number sold in the first 24 hours of iPhone 5 sales. And if you didn't get an iPhone 6 and can't wait the 3 to 4 weeks that they're now back-ordered, you'll be thrilled to know that you can now buy one on eBay. The going price is in the $3,000 to $4,000 range, unlocked, according to CNET. And as we reported last week, the iPhone 6 is so thin there isn't enough room for the camera optics, which stick out of the phone. Apple hides that fact, however, in its marketing photography. Silhouettes of the phone show the protuberance photoshopped out. Apple is such a perfectionist that even its own products aren't perfect enough. Wow, amazing. Well, our TNT fan of the day is Glenn Wilson in Scotland, who posted this picture on Twitter. He says that he watched the show recently on a flight to Washington, D.C. Look at that. Doesn't that look luxurious? It's good. That's like some serious business class right there.
Yeah, that's a nice flight.
Yeah.
Is it a fisheye lens? It must be.
Yeah. I love the fact that they've got this big, is that a removable like tablet that he took from the seat rest in front of him and put it on the...
It might just be his tablet.
Or it might be his tablet. He's ignoring the one provided by the
other. Those look whole up there.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
That's our kind of audience member. I don't need your fancy business class screen. I got my own.
No, but you know what's missing? TNT up there, TNT over there. There's plenty of screens here that aren't showing TNT. Come on, folks.
Well, we've got our work cut out for us. We're going to get this show on every single screen in the air. Well, how do you watch or listen to TNT? Just take a picture of your setup and post it on Google+, Twitter, or Facebook and use the hashtag #HowDoYouWatchTNT and we'll find it. That's the Tech News Today. Lindsay Turrentine, thank you so much for being our co-anchor again today and every Monday.
You're welcome. It was fun as usual.
So glad to have you on. We'll see you next Monday. Well, you can subscribe to Tech News Today on Stitcher, iTunes, YouTube, Feedly, Yahoo, RSS, and many other options. Choose your favorite at twit.tv/TNT. Follow us on Twitter at Tech News Today TV, and please send us your thoughts and opinions and ideas. Send email to tnt@twit.tv or leave voicemail by calling 260-TNT-SHOW. And don't miss our evening newscast, Tech News Tonight at 4 p.m. Pacific tonight and every weeknight right here on the Twit Network. My name is Mike Elgin. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you tomorrow. Nice.